Before we go any further, with the chairman's permission, I have a personal request for a moment of silence in behalf of a great lady of AA. The lady's name was Kathy from Las Vegas, if you care to join me. Thank you. So many of you knew her personally, and I need to say no more. Many of you knew her as a dedicated Third Legacy person. Many of you have heard of her. But for those of you who did not have the privilege of calling her a personal friend, and I would like to think that I did, all I can say is that she was one of the real people of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that phrase has a particular meaning to me. But knowing Kathy at this moment, I think that she would say to me in that clip staccato delivery of hers, "Jim, that's just about enough of that.
He says, time is short. You don't have that much time to waste. Get on doing that thing which you do best. That peculiar ability that you have to make more people madder faster with less effort than anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous." "I'm Jim Masterson from Carmichael, California, and I can't drink. Will you please shut up and let me tell my story in a dignified, trustee-type way? I'll start over. I'm Jim Masterson from Carmichael, California, and I can't drink. I never could. Then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out I never had to, so for a little less than 22 years, I ain't." And that's my story right there. But I got a little time left, I think. All through this assembly, conference, convention, get-together, bull session, whatever you want to call it all amounts to the same thing. I've been hearing everybody telling about their group being rated one, number one internationally. I belong to group three. In Sacramento. Yeah. And we ain't been rated yet. But that's known as the group where Jim Masterson goes to. And probably when we're eventually rated, we'll be rated X. But I'm real grateful to tell my story in just a few seconds tonight. Particularly tonight because I have some time left, as I said. But I'm grateful for the brevity of my A story because it's kind of a reversal of the prevalent trend in AA service talks. What in the hell am I talking about? The prevalent trend has been going on for years. For too many times, the service speaker, strides slowly to the podium with great dignity. Now, I tried to do that, but every time that I do it, I stub my toe, so I gave up. But he usually begins very eloquently and very dramatically. And he starts out like this, something like this: "I feel that service and Third Legacy are two of the most important entities of AA. And I want to stop right there. And for you newcomers to a service here, that word entity is a real barn burner in the service talk. And be sure and use it because it's very impressive and it's very confusing. Nobody knows what it means, but that's the whole idea behind it. You notice that all the old-time elder statesmen include that in their talk. Now, for the newcomers, an elder statesman is simply a bleeding deacon that ran out of blood. And some of us are pretty damned anemic, I can tell you that. But he goes on, the speaker, and he says these two facets of Alcoholics Anonymous service and Third Legacy of AA are vital, necessary, and we should lend our complete support, knowledge, and dedication to them because they are the heartbeat and the blood of our fellowship. And then there's a contemplative silence, and he majestically surveys his audience. You know, and then you just sit there with bated breath, waiting for his first words. And now, after the meeting, I like to talk to one of the vocabulary experts of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out how you wait with bated breath properly. Because I've always wanted to do this, but I wanted to do this. I wanted to wait with bated breath, and I leaned over to the woman next to me for a little bit of advice as how I could do this, and she kind of leaned back like that and looked at me, and she says, Maybe you better try scope or laboratory. Well, anyway, you're all fine, ready, and you're all ears for a service talk. And then that moment arrives. And the speaker takes a deep breath. Of course, if the speaker is a woman, then your interest in service is stimulated somewhat at that time. But he utters his beginning words, "I am an alcoholic. I took my first drink at the tender age of 13. I married the first of my three wives at 17 and made my first drunk tank before I was 18. And then for the next hour and a half, he gives you a beautiful AA talk. And it's a damn good one, too. And you stand up for the standing ovation because the talk is the kind of a talk that would demand a standing ovation. But you get a little embarrassed because you forget to sit down when everybody else does. Your mind is elsewhere trying to find out where you missed the service talk. Well, finally you get up the nerve enough to ask somebody. Well, they don't know either, but they won't admit it. But they always have a stock answer. They say, "Jim, it was kind of a hidden service message." And I have to agree with them there because it's so damn well hidden that nobody ever found it. Well, you try to stay hidden, too, from about four or five DSRs that you might have conned into coming to the convention, assembling, or get-together, whatever you want to call it. You conned them in to coming to this, taking time off that they could ill afford and spending money that they didn't have to hear a speaker on the three legacies of AA and the greatest story ever told, which is the story of AA and service. And you have a hunch that it's going to be a little hard to get them back to another service meeting. But you notice that all is not lost because there's other members from your area there too. And they're good active members too. At least I think they are. But you remember that they're the kind of people who you just mentioned two words, convention or conference, and right away they say, "Where do you pay the registration and where do you make the reservation?" This is before you even tell them where the conference is or what it's all about. They just simply are conference goers, and God bless them. I'm glad that they're here, and I hope that they'll be at all the other conferences. But they get there. But there's a couple things that they have in common. First of all, they can afford the time and the money to hit them all, and they do. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. And secondly, and I think this is really important, at least it is to me, and I could care less whether it's important to you or not. You see why I was referred to as a controversial character last night in the Third Legacy meeting. But I think this is very important, and it's very pertinent. Not one of them would be caught dead at a service meeting in our local area. Now, the obvious rebuttal to this is, well, at least it can't happen here. And the rebuttal to the rebuttal, it not only can, but it did. Because I can remember one of the Pacific Region assemblies, and if you think I'm going to tell you which one it is, you're a damn fool. Nevertheless, we had three speakers on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoon on recovery, unity, and service, and that meeting ordered. And they gave tremendous talks. And it was completely devoid of the first legacy of the steps, the second legacy of the traditions, and the third legacy of service. And I kind of left wondering where I blanked out or goofed. You just wonder if maybe this might be some of the possible explanations to why we don't get the enthusiasm in service meeting attendance that we should have. Maybe we should talk about service at a service meeting. Maybe it's the same kind of a feeling that you had when at your local group, the local GSR asked for a moment or two at the end of the meeting to tell a group about a couple of hot items that they just got from New York, from GSO. And the secretary recognizes how this is a good idea. 40 minutes later, he's still on his feet, clarifying a redistricting problem in the area, evaluating the expenditures of money involved to pay the expenses of various officers of service to the next contemplated service get-together. Or maybe he's regaling the group with the detailed data on the need for an extra delegate for the area. And you remember you and the rest of the membership got a little bit restless and antsy. Really, what you got was bored and disinterested. And yet, maybe you kind of felt sorry for the GSR because you had this feeling this is the first time that he's ever had the floor in that particular meeting, and he figures maybe it's the last one he'll ever have. And he usually is. Maybe it's the same feeling that you had when you said you were going to go to a genuine service meeting and you were going to stick it out. And he had one of the, well, what do you call it, the political general service people at that meeting. And he's been a general service people since Methuselah was young. But he was very impressive, too. And you sat there and listened to him. And he talked about a lot of things because he had a very good vocabulary. And he talked about Third Legacy and General Service and Policy Committee and Service Trustees, Class A, Class B, Regional Trustees, AAWS, GSO, Alcoholic Board Members, Non-Alcoholic Board Members, DCMs, GSRs, Committeeman PIC Panels, Areas, Provinces, Regions, Finance Committees, Internationalists, International Research, Central Offices, Intergroups, Loaners, Monthly Contributions, Birthday Plans, Yearly donations, conference, conventions, rallies, Al-Anon, Alateen, Alitops, prenatal disposition towards alcohol. You know. And you know, when he gets through, you just kind of have a feeling he doesn't really know what he's talking about. And so you go up to him and you ask him to explain it all. And he stutters and stammers for just a very few moments. And then he regains his composure. And he looks at you with great benevolence. He says, well, I'll tell you, it gets a little bit complicated, but when you're sober as long as I am, you'll understand it all. Now you see why I got the reputation that I say out loud what other people think and keep underneath their breath. But anyway, somehow that answer doesn't seem to satisfy you, particularly if you're one of the new breed of service people that we're getting in AA today. Because the new people are different and they're confusing to the old timer. They're not exactly different and confusing. They're smarter. That's what they are. And you know, our longevity in service is no longer awe-inspiring. The fact that we've been a committeeman, a delegate, or a trustee, or something other unimportant wheel in AA that's equally irrelevant no longer suffices as an adequate answer, and I'm just tickled to death about that. Maybe you attended a lot of service meetings and you notice that the same old faces are up at the chair or up at the podium. And maybe this makes you wonder just a little bit too. And so much of the time when they're up there, the subject is the same. The necessity of rotation. New blood in AA. And it is a good conversational piece. The question is your mind, if you're new, why don't they put their money where their mouth is? And in actuality, that's the reason that I'm up here tonight. That's the real reason that I'm here. Now that makes an awful lot of sense, doesn't it? I'm up here at the podium for one reason, to tell you why I shouldn't be here. The obvious question follows, then, what in the hell are you doing up there? I don't like profanity in meetings, but sometimes in order to put a point across, I'm going to go ahead and use it. So you could ask me, why didn't you turn it down and refuse to be the Saturday night speaker? And it's a good question, and I think I've got what I think is a good answer. I did, at a previous conference, and I was raked over the coals for so doing. But I'll get into that just a little bit later. And maybe you've got the idea now why, if you're a newcomer, your sponsor suggested that the best time to see Las Vegas and really see the sights of Las Vegas as they should be seen is between 8 and 10 on Saturday night. Because they know that I'm a calculated risk as a participant. I'm very undependable, and they never know what I'm going to say, and that makes us even up because I don't know either. But I think it's only fair to warn you, as I have done to other groups, to warn you that I'm completely devoid of tact. And you, most of you know what tact is. That's the ability that a person has when you get real mad at him, you want to tell him where to go, does it so beautifully that the fellow looks forward to the trip. And I don't have that, you see. And so I want to give you the chance early in the meeting here right now. If you want to leave at this point, you can go ahead and you can walk out and pretend that you've got to go to the potty and just forget to come back. And nobody's going to know the difference. Of course, it might be a blow to your sense of omnipotence and sense of indispensability that if you don't come back, nobody's going to miss you anyway. But in fact, I'll even go further than that. If you really want to put me in my place and get up and walk out on me right now, I'll stop talking. And we'll have in a moment of silent attention so that all of the eyes of the assembly will be upon you and you will get the attention that you so thoroughly are looking for. Now, I have to be a little bit careful when I issue that invitation because I did this in Chattanooga here a few years back. And after the meeting was over, one of the people who came up on the stage, she waited out the line. It was a little lady who looked me right in the eye and she said, "Jim Masterson, I love you. But you're a sadistic and cruel person. And evidently, you enjoy inflicting pain and suffering on the innocent." Well, it seems that prior to the main meeting, she had drank an awful lot of coffee. And after sitting through all the preliminaries and all the introductions and the dignitaries and the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and everything else that went with them, she legitimately had to avail herself of the services of the women's restroom. But she had heard my reputation that I would carry through with what I said I would do, and according to her, she gritted her teeth and she sat through my whole talk in pain, misery, and as she put it, fear. And then she paid me what I like to consider is the finest compliment I have ever had. And I've had a few. Very few, I grant you that, but I have had a few. But she paid me the nicest compliment I think I've ever had. She said that after listening to what I had to say in my talk, that all of a sudden at the end, she realized that she had forgotten how badly she had to go in the first place. Now, that is a compliment of the highest order. And I've never forgotten that sweet little face, strained and tense as it was, as she left the stage very early. But maybe I better explain a little bit further that she was an Al-Anon. Which only goes to prove what I heard a man say one time. Come to think about it, it was me. That Al-Anons are cunning, powerful, cunning, baffling, and very, very powerful. And her tenacity and bladder control and stubborn unwillingness to give in to Mother Nature only proves the point. And incidentally, she told me that the reason that she became so interested in what I had to say, that it was the first time in 18 years of Al-Anon activity that she had ever heard an alcoholic stand right up in front of the convention and God and everybody and talk about Al-Anons just as if they were regular human beings. I feel very comfortable now. I always like to check and see if there are any Al-Anons in the group. I presume that there are. Are there any Al-Anons here? Thank you very much. I feel much better. I feel much better. Because this is my security blanket, you see, because if I get in too much trouble with the Alfies, I just switch it over and we make an Al-Anon meeting and I know who's in control then. And I know whereof I speak because I lived with an understanding Al-Anon for quite a few years, and that's the worst kind. Because the more they understand, the less you can get away with. But I better get off that subject. But I would like to say that any remarks that I might make this evening apply equally to the Al-Anons, I should say, here in the hall, because for those of you in AA who don't know, and that includes a hell of a lot of you, Al-Anon has a world service structure that's just as well organized and just as effective as ours is. And I think I'll just stop right there by repeating once again what I heard a man say, and he's always criticized for saying it, but he goes ahead and says it anyway. Come to think about it, that was me too. That the Fellowship of Al-Anon has had the greatest impact on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous
of anything since the Jack Alexander Saturday Evening Post article in 1941. And I firmly believe it. The only trouble is that most AAs ain't found that out yet. But I would suggest maybe that they start to find out about it, or we're liable to find a tail running around wagging a dog. Well, by this time, as you're new and uninitiated, you can see why I'm known as a controversial character. But before the Al-Anons get carried away with their moment of glory here, I want to ask each of you Al-Anons if you think you measure up to the standards of the model or the ideal life of an alcoholic. And that's a voluptuous, blonde nymphomaniac who owns a financially successful liquor store. Well, I see that I have some time left, but I honestly don't agree with it. It was suggested that I select a title for what I have to say tonight. Being that this is the age of the boob tube, I think the most fitting title that I could come up with tonight was You Asked For It. But there was an alternate title from the same source, and if I were expected to cover all the variety of service experiences that have been mine over the past some 22 years that directly or indirectly affect the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, the title should be Mission Impossible, because I can't do it. But right now there are several questions in my mind. What am I doing here anyway? Why did I come to Las Vegas, and what should I talk about? There's many members in the audience who are asking the same question. But I have one thing that makes me feel good, that I know that the future of Alcoholics Anonymous is not going to be affected one way or the other by what I have to say here tonight. Now, one reason that I'm here is because I was invited, and that always helps if you're going to be up here. And it was a rather interesting invitation. It was sort of a progressive feeler type invitation. Now, these are not the exact words, and it's not exactly the way that it happens, or it happened, but it makes a better story this way, and so I'm going to use it. But basically, it went just about like this. I got a phone call and says, "How are you, Jim? I haven't seen you for a long time. How are you doing?" And this was followed by the normal AA bullshit communication talk. And finally, the blow was struck. The fellow said, and I consider him a very good friend of mine, incidentally, and I hope he takes this right, and I know that he will, and we'll argue about it. He says, "Jim, you knew that the Pacific Region Assembly was going to be held in Las Vegas," and I admitted that I was aware of the fact. And he said, "Well, the committee sort of decided that maybe we'd like to have you as a Saturday night podium spot speaker at the assembly." Well, it was a long silence, and being that I didn't give him any particular advice where to go or where to shove it, the communication continued. He said, "We just heard a rumor as if you had changed your mind about the assembly." And then there was a long pause again. And then I said, "No, I haven't changed my mind whatsoever." And then there was a dead silence. You know, just the silent periods of that phone call must have cost a fortune. I'm sure that the operator must have thought that there was a couple drunks on the phone, and there was. But anyway, he said, "Would you consider it?" And I allowed as how I would on my basis. And he said that I would probably be contacted by the committee. And I was. And I said yes. But the second question was pertinent, I think, because it gives rise to another question. What was it that I had thought about the assembly in the first place that would necessitate a change of heart before I would participate here in Las Vegas? Well, I didn't realize that I had had an opinion that had to be changed, unless it was sort of confusion at the time. You see, I didn't know that there was going to be a Pacific Region Assembly until about 2 or 3 months before it was to become a reality. And it's the honest to God truth. You see, I had been raised in the service doctrine that anything that happened in AA was based on an imperative need. Now, possibly I was asleep or something. I don't know. But I honestly had not been aware of the tremendous need for all of the areas in the Pacific region to gather together. I just accepted the fact
that I'd been goofing off in my conscious contact with a membership of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I checked with some of my local information sources, and it appears that they had been asleep too. But then we're from Northern California, and that explains an awful lot right there. And I didn't think too much about it until I started getting some phone calls from Southern California, and they said, "Look, Masterson, what gives with this Pacific Region Assembly? What brought all this on?" And it was evident that some of them were as confused as I was. So you can't blame me for being just a little bit apprehensive about the origin of the mandatory need. I've got to be honest about it. So, if changing my mind about the assembly means that I will get up here and admit that I was caught with my pants down, then I will admit that. However, I take consolation in the fact that I was not alone, because all over the Pacific region, there were active service and AA members running around also with droopy drawers and their trousers at half-mast. But a long time ago, I learned that when there's a need for a service, then any one member or any large group of members, regardless of who they are or how much they try to do it, cannot prevent that need from being fulfilled. So I haven't bothered to question the validity of this assembly whatsoever, and I'm all for it. It would be useless for me to talk otherwise. I think that this is the sixth assembly, if I'm correct. I've attended two of them up to this point. The others I've missed for a very good reason. I mentioned earlier that I had turned down the privilege of participating in a Saturday night meeting, and that's true. At one of the assemblies, I was asked to be the podium speaker on Saturday night, and I said no, and I said no for what I thought was a good, legitimate reason. And that reason was that I find it very difficult and painful to try to talk out of both sides of my mouth at the same time. Many AA members seem to do this with ease, but due to my fetching up and my sponsor, it just didn't seem to be my bag. But you see, it's just a few months prior to this, I talked at the Southern California Convention in San Diego, and the subject of my part in the meeting was rotation and the need for replacing ourselves well in advance of the time that the replacement would be needed. And evidently the talk was fairly well taken down there. Well, after expounding on rotation and in suggesting that some of us who have had the so-called spotlight for so long step down and out of the way, it seemed a little bit ridiculous to me to show up on the speaker's podium just a few months later at the Pacific Region Assembly on Saturday night. It just didn't make sense, so I very simply said no, and it was just as simple as that. And this is important to me. It may not be important to you, but it is to me. Because so many of us who have had the chance, the privileges, have been around for a while, and have been... We like to talk about rotation and bemoan the fact that the newer members of Alcoholics Anonymous are just not available or interested. And then at the same time, the moment we have the chance to get out of the way, it's just one more time. It's kind of like when we were back in the old days, you know. Just one more time. I'll go in this drunk tonight, and then tomorrow I'll sober up. The same thing in this front. We'll hog the spotlight just one more conference, and then we'll rotate. And I can't blame the new people of AA for getting a little bit discouraged and asking the question, when are they going to get off the pot and do it? And then after I said no and suggested that this spot might be allotted to one of the lesser lights, if I can use that word there, it's not long before I heard a well-founded rumor. I didn't say fact, I said rumor. That's why I had not accepted the invitation. And basically, I heard that the real reason I had declined was because my expenses had not been paid to the conference. That if my expenses had been paid as they had been to San Diego, then I would have been most willing to come and speak. And maybe that's the real reason that I came here to Las Vegas tonight, to set that rumor to rest, because I can assure you that I paid my own expenses to San Diego to talk about rotation at their invitation. And that may not be important to you either, but it's important to me. I remember it very well, because when I went to pay my hotel bill at the Grand Hotel, I was told that the room payment had been taken care of by The local committee. They didn't say which local committee, but you don't let the gift horse in the mouth, you know. And I went home, and it wasn't too long before I received the bill from the hotel grant that I owed them for two nights' lodging. Well, I sort of grinned because this has happened before, and I sent a nice, polite note back to them explaining that there had evidently been some kind of a misunderstanding, as the room had been taken care of by the local committee, as I had been informed by the desk clerk. Well, evidently, somebody had had a change of heart someplace along, because after two more duns, the bill ended up in the hands of the local retail credit association in Sacramento for collection, courtesy of the hotel grant and Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I finally got this straightened out, and I paid the bill and got straightened out with the RCA, which was important to me because I worked for almost 15 years to get that credit rating up to where it was, and didn't want to lose it. But you can see that there was no doubt that I paid my way, and I understand that I paid my way to San Diego, and PSA won't let you on those planes without a little bit of loot, I can tell you that. Now, the only reason that I emphasize this point is to bury this rumor relative to my negative answer about speaking at the conference, because it was very important to me that I back up what I talked about in San Diego, and that was rotation. And the point is that some of us have had the leading roles in the Third Legacy play for so long, it's about time that we surrender the script to the understudy, and it's a capable understudy. And it's true that we do surrender this script to the capable understudy, but we're always continually in the wings. And the minute the spotlight goes on, we take back over. It seems to me that what we need to do, and that's what I meant to do in refusing to be the Saturday night keynote speaker, if I can call it that, is to hand over the script. And this is what we should do, hand over the script. Get the hell out of the wings and go sit out in the audience, and the understudy will play the part much better than we ever did. In other words, as some of the newcomers put it, don't talk about it, do it. But in fairness to some of us, and give us credit for something, that's a lot easier to do than it's easy to stand up and say do it. But it's not quite that easy to do because, for one thing, if you're like me, you have to contend with flattery, and that's tough. Okay, then we follow with another legitimate question. And what in the heck are you doing at this Saturday night meeting here in Las Vegas? And maybe there's a couple answers to that. First of all, I'm here that so somebody could come up and ask me as I walked into the conference, if you were not speaking here at Las Vegas on Saturday night, would you be here? To which I could reply, no, I wouldn't. And then they could ask, why not? And then I could explain, because I couldn't afford the time and the money to be here. And that's important. And I think that that issue, or reality, is vitally important in the evaluation and the conduct of this assembly. It is to me. Maybe it isn't to you. And I'm only talking about the things that are important to me up here tonight. But the reality of which ones can afford the time and the money to attend the assembly. Now, you can say that this is totally unimportant, and I'd agree with you. As long as this assembly confines itself to stimulating interest in the Third Legacy and service in any given area, I'm all for it. I already said this. It's wonderful. It's terrific. This whole thing has been good. I'm all for it as sort of a rotating service get-together composed of those AA members within the local area and any and all others who can afford the time and money to attend. But if and when the assembly becomes a body that's capable of passing regional resolutions and delegating supposedly spokesmen for the region at the level of the yearly conference, or poses to be the completely informed conscience of the entire Pacific region as such, then the question of who can afford to be here becomes very important in my mind. Whether you agree or not, I could care less again. Now, I haven't answered the question that's in your mind right now. Were your expenses paid for this trip? I know it's on your mind. You don't have to tell me.
The answer is no. I paid my own expenses to be here tonight. But in fairness to the convention committee, I will say that they most graciously offered to pay any expenses incurred in coming here. And I turned them down. But this is no big deal. So I paid my own expenses. So did you, unless you're a delegate from an area that could afford to pay your way here. But to me, that's not the point. The point is that there are thousands of others, and there's hundreds and hundreds in my particular area, many of them GSRs, who would like to be here and should be here if this is to be a true regional assembly conscience. I think it's logical to ask why I'm here if I couldn't afford it, and when I say, at least, that I am so dead set on this rotation of our so-called leader. And it just occurred to me there might be just one or two new members here tonight who might be wondering also what it's all about. And they can't get the simple answers they want on a simple, understandable explanation. But I think the real reason that I've avoided the final approach to any subject at all is because I'm not quite sure what I want to talk about. For many years, I've been a loner in the area of AA and service interpretations. This has never bothered me at all because this seems to have been my niche as a GSR, as a committeeman, as a delegate, and a trustee. And just because you're a has-been or a never-was in some people's mind doesn't mean that you lose your interest in what's going on in AA, nor do you lose your willingness to stick your neck out and become an alarmist. And being kind of called an alarmist, and I've been called this many times, has never bothered me because you people would not even be here at this Las Vegas Assembly, Pacific Region Las Vegas Assembly, if you'd rather, if it were not for the greatest alarmist of them all, Bill W. Because, you see, because he became alarmed that there was no evident vocal communication between the grassroots of AA and our Board of Trustees in New York, he got scared. And as a result of his persistent efforts to establish some kind of a two-way communication, the yearly service conference and the Third Legacy structure as such came into being. So if there weren't an alarmist like Bill in our fellowship, you wouldn't be here tonight. So this doesn't bother me at all. But after thinking about it and rereading it, I still think that the greatest story ever told, which is a very simple story of AA's beginning, is simple, it's concise, it's logical, and above all, it's believable truth. It didn't become complicated and misinterpreted until you and I got a hold of it and started to tell the founders what they were trying to say. And I don't think that we know this. But I suppose that I could say to today I am alarmed. I'm a little bit concerned. I'm also a little bit interested. And I see nothing wrong with this at all. I wish more people were alarmed and concerned. This doesn't mean that you're pessimistic at all. Not to me, anyway. But I find myself, I'll be honest with you, I find myself sitting all alone sometimes just thinking and wondering how few members today know the simple story of the Three Legacy or seem even interested in finding out what it's all about. It scares me when I think how easy it is to forget what the Mr. Rockefeller gave to us when he said that since obviously, quote, since obviously AA was a work of pure goodwill, one man carrying the good news to the next, that little or no money would be required. It scares me when I think how few people know why the regions were originally designed. I almost vomited when I saw the box 459 that comes out from New York. And some of you might have read it, and it had on the front page of it, do you need a top-notch speaker for your area? In fact, I vomited twice. They even went so far as to follow this through and say, if you do, we will help pay the expenses of, and so on. This scares the hell out of me. I don't know whether it does out of you, but it does out of me. I don't think we need that. Or I could say that I'm concerned about the thing that Les didn't have the time to talk about last night, our concern over the leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous and the methods of selecting leaders. I'm not talking about the leaders right now, but we're going to have leaders if there's going to be a future in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's going to come from the newcomers who are here tonight. But the method of selecting those leaders is very important, and I think that you have a responsibility, everybody does, to find out how we select these leaders so that we'll get the ones who will be the proper voice for you and I back at the assembly in New York. Ask around and find out. Just don't ask one person, but ask a lot of people and make up your own mind. You've got minds. Why don't you use them? Sure, this scares me. And every time I say this, somebody will get up and say, don't worry about it, Jim. God will always place the right leaders in the right place. We don't have to. Maybe that's the reason I decided to come to Las Vegas. Because it seems to me that I've had my shot at solutions and rightfully should be off to the side and available. But it occurs to me that there are only two vital answers that will eventually solve what problems we might have in Alcoholics Anonymous today or ever will have. And I think they'll be found only one place. And I think that that is what I think is the greatest story ever told, which is very simply the story of Alcoholics Anonymous from the beginning to where most of us took over and begin to interpret that which cannot be interpreted. Now, I realize that my time is going right along here, and I don't want to put off the business meeting, which starts at 12 o'clock, I think it is. Right? I don't know, maybe I come in the wrong area. I started in 1951, and that was a great year for Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the year of our first service conference. And if you remember, I said service conference, not general service. I said service conference. It was also the year that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and took my last drink. Now I have to share this with Eric from Washington because he also came in the same year. However, he's sitting down there, and I'm standing up here, so he doesn't count tonight. But I still think it was a great year, but so far nobody has made a motion to make it a commemorative year. It seems like an awful good idea to me. But that was the year that I met my sponsor, Mac, and he explained the three legacies to me. And he showed showed me the wisdom of the man, because you see, this was 4 years before we ever had the third legacy, and he explained it to me. But the way he put it to me, it sounded so logical and so simple. He told me about the 12 steps, and then he told me about the 12 traditions, and then he told me about the conference that they had just had back in New York, and very simply he said, now we have an influential voice in AA all over the world. I guess maybe that interest in and the support of our GSO and World Services has become sort of a habit of mine since that time. You see, Mac, right in the very beginning, now you don't know whether I'm telling the truth or not. And I could care less again. But this is the way that it happened. Mac made me start putting in a dime a month in order to pay the debt that I owed to those people who had paid the price. And the silver platter, I needed it. And in those days, it was only a dollar a year. So for those first 2 years, I figured that I've got 20 cents refund coming for each year. But he never let me forget how simply AA started and why it grew. And I guess that must have been the way that I wanted to hear it, because I've never been able to shake that simple explanation in the years since, regardless of how hard I have tried to complicate it. And it just seems to me that the basics upon which AA grew and survived and become what it is today, The basics I'm talking about are just as contemporary today as they were in the beginning, regardless of what anybody else says about change. But they must be, for me at least, because any time I want an answer, all I have to do is go back to the beginning, platform of AA, and there the answer is. Now, you don't hear the simple story of AA too much anymore. But it just occurred to me, if I took this time and came to Las Vegas, there might be these couple of newcomers who might be interested, and this could be my last opportunity to tell it in the way that it was told to me.
The whole thing started when two men sat down across the table just to have a cup of coffee. And one man's name was Bill, and he was a stockbroker. And the other man's name was Bob, and he was a doctor. And that was a pattern in itself, because even their names were simple. And then they shared a cup of coffee. And he exchanged feelings and experiences, that's all, nothing else. No medicine, no advice, no pills, no nothing. Nothing but an exchange of feelings and experiences. And right there we basically have the first pattern for our AA meetings. And it still stands as far as I'm concerned. A very simple, unscientific explanation of how it works by Bill to Bob. And in its most abbreviated form, we had our first legacy in 1935, the legacy of recovery. And isn't that what Bill was telling Bob? What steps he would have to take? When Bob asked Bill, do I have to go on this way? And Bill said, no. There's another way out if you want to take it. And then he told him what he had done, what Bill had done. And that answer finally became the 12 steps of AA, or the third legacy of recovery, first legacy of recovery. And in that same year, the second legacy became necessary. And maybe this is oversimplified, but this is the way I see it as happening. The second legacy became necessary because after that first cup of coffee, Bill and Dr. Bob had their first argument of fight, and disunity began in AA and has reigned supreme ever since. You see, they wanted to go out and talk to a third drunk, and Bill had his way of talking to a drunk, and Dr. Bob had a completely different approach. But they both took a deep breath, and they looked each other in the eye, and then they set the pattern for unity as I see it ever since. Instead of stomping out in righteous indignation, Dr. Bob sat down and listened to Bill explain his method. And then Bill, and this was hard for him to do, sat down and listened while Dr. Bob talked about his approach. And even though they didn't completely agree, they did set up a compromise that satisfied both of them. And right there we had our second legacy of unity in a capsule form of what we call now the 12 traditions. Actually, there were really a set of rules so that they could keep on fighting, but at least they could fight fair. And then he went off to talk to the third drunk. And when they did that, we suddenly had our third legacy, the legacy of service, because that's what AA service really is, carrying the message to the sick alcoholic. And at that point, they all set a model or a pattern or a definition of what kind of a message do we carry, and what sick alcoholic do we have a responsibility to carry it to? The only message that they had to carry was very simple. It was not a lecture on alcoholism. It wasn't a spiritual approach in its basic form. It wasn't a message of, fearful consequences. It was not an intellectual presentation. And above all, they didn't see fit to contact the potential alcoholic. They carried their message to the drunk who was already there. The guy or the gal who already had qualified as a drunk and had asked for help. That's the ones that they carried the message to. And it seems to me that that's the ones that we should be carrying the message to and be concerned about today. The only message they had to carry was that there was a way out for the guy or the gal who had reached that point of no return and they still wanted to come back. And it was a simple message of hope, that's all. But equally as important in my mind is the fact that they carried this message to the alcoholic or drunk who asked for help in whatever way they might have asked. But sometime in the time since, we got this a little bit mixed up. And we've lost the content of this simple message, and we got mixed up in who we're to carry the message to. But to me, that defines the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, to carry the message of hope to the sick alcoholic who has already arrived and is asking for help. And we're going to have our hands full until the year 2000 on that basis and with that kind of alcoholic. And AA grew with leaps and bounds, and they were just having a wee of a time talking to drunks right and left. And they assumed that they didn't know what they was doing, but they assumed they must be doing something right, because every once in a while, one of them would holler at the other one after exchanging their experience, strength, and hope with a good solid failure.
And he'd stand back and he'd say, "Hey, look at this. He's sober. I wonder what happened." And you know, they didn't really know what happened. And I don't think we still know what happened and why it happens. And so they went on about their business of talking to drunks on a one-to-one basis. And many people were watching them in those days. They were very impressed. The funny part is that the people in AA in those days weren't even trying to impress anybody. But everybody saw what they were doing. The clergy, the medical profession, news media, industry, all of them. But it was kind of frustrating to many of them, particularly in the field of alcoholism, because they didn't seem to be interested in solving the problem of alcoholism. And that frustrated the hell out of them. Actually, we all know that it's not true, but they had their hands full talking to drunks on a single one-to-one basis, and we haven't run out of that kind of drunk in 38 years. And then when the other agencies in the field of alcoholism begin to ask questions like, "What are you doing to these people? Do you care if we take notes? Do you care if we look on? Do you care if we borrow some of yours to use in some of ours?" Dr. Bob and Bill said, "Heck no, anything we've got, anything we've been through, anything we can give to you, it's all yours. You can have it. All we ask is that you don't get in our way and we won't get in yours." And that was our first cooperation, but not affiliation. They basically told him, "You operate in your field and we'll operate in ours." I still think it's a good idea today. You know, even at that time, Bill and Dr. Bob recognized that there was a large field of alcoholism, and there was, many years ago. But they also were wise enough to accept the fact that our place as Alcoholics Anonymous in the field of alcoholism was way down in the corner, down sort of in the South 40. And that South 40 was a little bit weedy and muddy when we moved in and took it over. But in the last 38 years, we've cleaned it up until it's become quite respectable and comfortable. But that small South 40 has one unexplainable asset, and it's been brought out in this assembly, that it has an unlimited capacity to handle more residents as the need arises. But they realized that we had to stay down in the South 40, and we'd do all right. And I think that this is our job, to stay in the South 40. Because they found out in the beginning that every time one of their more zealous members, ambitious members, started to get out of the South 40 and went up in the big field and started to tell them how to run their business, they got in trouble, and they got kicked back down. I'll admit that they cheated in the beginning. AA, because he used by accident the most powerful publicity gimmick ever known to man, the gimmick of example. They didn't go all over, as many of us do today, telling everybody how good they were, what they had done, what they were doing, and what they could do, and how big they were. They just went out and done it. And that's mighty damn powerful attraction and publicity, I can tell you that. But they really cheated when they made a deal with God. Now, you and I know today that you can't make deals with God, but they hadn't found that out at that time. Actually, the way that it happened was that one of the spiritual experts at that time, and they had him then too, he said, "Look, this is a God-given program," and he did it with tears in his eyes. Now, this is something that I always wish that I had, even as a trustee. I never could squeeze a tear out, not even one. But with tears in their eyes, they say this is a God-given program. Well, nobody seemed to argue with him on that. And he says, "Look, quit spinning your wheels. Quit worrying about this. And don't worry. All you have to do is just turn the program over to God, and he'll take care of it." Well, that sounded pretty impressive and interesting, because everybody was getting a little bit pooped in those days anyway. But oddly enough, every time that they turned the program over to God and sat down, nothing happened. So they had a prayer meeting with God. Actually, what they had was a bull session. That's what they had with God. And it went something like this. They said, "Look, God, every time we turn our program and our activities over to you and sit down, so do you. And we ain't getting no place at all that way, so we'd like to make a deal with you. Basically, what we'll do the work that's required down here on Earth, and then you determine the results of what we do down here from up there, and we'll accept the results as thy will. And God allowed us how that was an acceptable arrangement, and so they went back to their business of talking to drunks on a one-to-one basis. Now, I don't have the time to talk about everything that I want to talk about. But it was evident at that time that we had a nice, solid, well-rounded program. And I have it right here. Now, there is a nice, solid, well-rounded piece of program. It's solid maple. Very good. And that was what we thought we had at that time. It was evident that the news of AA was spreading out, and thousands more all over the world wanted to know more about this program. So someone suggested to the early people in AA, they said, look, these people want to know what you did. So why don't you sit down and put down on paper what you decided it was that you were going to do to get sober and stay sober. Well, to Bill, that was just like waving a red flag at a bull. And so they all got together to decide, and they sat down to decide what they had originally decided to do in order to get sober. And finally, they just gave up. And he went back to the people and he said, look, we give up because we suddenly realized that we hadn't really decided to do anything by design. But here are 12 simple sentences, and as best we can recollect, these are basically the things that we did, and evidently they must have been the right things to do, because we're all sober and happy today. Now, everybody has always wanted to change the big book. And that's the only change that I would like to change in the big book is the title of the fifth chapter, because I would like to have it read, How It Works, Evidently. So right then and there, with those 12 simple sentences, we were handed our first legacy, because those 12 sentences became the 12 steps of AA. And AA grew by leaps and bounds all over the country, because AAs are, maybe I better put the first leg on here, and it squeaks a lot when I put it on, and my wife wouldn't let me put anything in there so it wouldn't squeak, but we did have a leg on the stool. But as it grew, because AAs by nature are individualists, and they never agree on anything, and we had our growing pains, and we began to fight and argue amongst ourselves, and this created a new need for a set of guidelines. They were not demands for rules as such. There wasn't even an intention of a ceasefire, you know. They wanted to keep on fighting and arguing. This was necessary because, you know, you take away the opportunity of AA members to fight, argue, interpret, and misinterpret, and you wouldn't have any membership. Nobody would come around. It would get kind of dull. Wouldn't it be the dullest thing in the world if everybody followed the traditions? Thank God for the people that don't, and that blesses us all, I guess. But it did seem that we could take the mistakes and the errors of the past and developing some sort of operating procedure, then it could act as a fairly reliable guide. Not, as I say, that they would stop fighting, but at least they would be allowed to, as I said before, to fight fair. And these guidelines, based on past experience, both good and bad, success and failure, trial and error, but above all, anchored on experience, not theory, became what we know as the 12 traditions of AA, or the second legacy. So we can put another leg on this stool, I think. Yeah, I went in. Well, my wife must have remodeled that one. Now, everybody was pretty well satisfied. In case you wondered, those not are beer cans, that's Fresca. Frankly, everybody was satisfied with our program, with the exception of Bill. And he became an alarmist once again. And you can't see this over here, so come up after the meeting and I'll put it together again. Probably Bill's greatest asset to our fellowship was his uncanny ability to project into the future. He had the attribute of tremendous vision, if he had nothing else. And he said, there's something wrong. There's something that's left out, and I can't quite put my finger on it. And then by accident, he referred to our AA structure as a three-legged stool that was solid and well-balanced. And he visualized the three-legged stool and found the missing link that he was so concerned about. It was true that we had a solid three-legged stool as such, and we did. That's solid. We had the steps, the tradition, and the contacts between the grassroots out here in Las Vegas and New York. But then Bill realized that he and Dr. Bob and the other old-timers of that day were acting as the vocal contact or the communication or the interpreters between Las Vegas, your area, and New York. And the truth came to him that he and Dr. Bob and the other old-timers would not always be here. And then what would happen to this solid three-legged stool after they left us? It's not too hard to visualize what would happen. The whole thing would fall down. There would be no link when they passed on between Las Vegas and groups all over the United States and Canada and our service headquarters in New York. And so, against the arguments of many people back there, he and Dr. Bob planned a yearly service conference to make certain that that solid third leg would always be there in the future. Now, they knew the limitations of the conference, and they knew that everybody couldn't come to New York for a conference. So they devised a simple plan where one man or one woman would be selected to come to New York in April once a year and meet with its staff and the trustees and the delegates from all over the AA world. It was just as simple as that. Very simply, this one man or woman would act as the voice of AA and speak for every service and every area on whatever problems might arise or present themselves. And they agreed to give it a try for 5 years to see if it would work, and it did. And so in 1955 in St. Louis, as was explained last night, the conference became a permanent reality. And Bill stepped on off the stage and said in so many words, "Now I'm happy because that third leg is a solid and a permanent one. And finally we have the third solid leg to the three-legged stool of Alcoholics Anonymous." And it was solid. And Bill knew that it was going to stay solid from that time on. At that time, he gave us our third legacy of service, and his third legacy was nothing more than a plan where every AA service anywhere could be represented and heard throughout the medium of a yearly conference and their elected delegate. And that was when Bill turned the fellowship over to us. Now, I don't think that most of the old-timers are going to change too much at this point. So it looks to me as if it's up to the newcomers in AA to take over and make sure that this three-legged stool stays solid. I think that one of the hardest jobs that you're going to have is try to explain the third legacy. You won't have any trouble explaining to your constituents, if you want to call it that, explain to them what the first and second legacies are. But the third legacy is going to be a son of a gun. And basically, what it amounts to is this, that the third legacy is a three-legged stool, too. It's here, there, and in between. And the in-between is the delegate, who is going to go back between here and there, which is Las Vegas and New York, and act as the influential voice speaking for you back at the yearly conference, and that's the only thing that your delegate ever does. He can't get anything done. He can only be an influential voice so that when the Board of Trustees has to make decisions that affect us all, that our opinions are influencing their thinking and their actions. That's all that they're doing. And so it's up to you, new people in AA, to act as the third leg, the influential voice of Las Vegas or wherever you might come from. Sure, I've talked a lot about the newcomers of AA tonight. Maybe a little too much. But I feel that the future of Alcoholics Anonymous lies in the hands of the people who are here maybe 6 months, a year, 2 years, or 3 years. And if you're not ready to take it over, and if we're not willing to turn it over to you, man, we're in trouble for the future. Because we ain't always going to be around. Now, I'd like to end up my portion of this thing in the same way that I've done it many times. And it may not make any sense to you, but it does to me. Maybe you can take it negatively or you can take it positively. I don't care. But I'd like to look at it as a kind of a reminder to me personally. I'm really bothered by what I call a reoccurring nightmare. And in this nightmare, I see the headlines of the paper in 1999. And the headlines read, "Alcoholism is number one killer in the world." Now, that's nothing new to you and I now. The only difference is that finally the truth has made the headlines. But then on the back page, down in the lower corner, there's a very small article, and it's titled in small print, "New Approach for the Drunk." Maybe there's about 10 lines, and it's about this unique bunch of drunks and their activities. And so just for fill-in, the editor sent a cub reporter out to see what it was all about. And when he returned, the editor said, "Well," because the reporter had kind of a funny look on his face. He said, "That's the damnedest thing I ever saw." He says, "What it amounts to is simply that this guy and this gal, who were both drunks, they met one night, and they sat down and had a cup of coffee. And they told each other how they felt and what all had happened to each one of them. And it seems that as a result of this back and forth communication, they both got sober and stayed sober. Then they went out and talked to a third guy, and he got sober too, even though everyone all over had given up on all three of them. And just for the heck of it, the three of them went out and talked to a fourth gal, who was really a mess. Same thing. She got sober. And now they got almost 100 members all over the United States who have gotten sober the same way. And evidently they're getting an awful lot of correspondence and letters. And so the editor asked how they operated and what happened. And the reporter said, "I'll be darned if I know. I don't think they really know either. But it doesn't seem to make too much difference to them." He said, "I asked them some questions and they gave me the silliest answers." He said, "I asked about money and they said they didn't want any or need any because it would spoil what they had." He said, "They called it a spiritual program, and when I tried to find out what religion they belonged to, they said none of them and all of them. They said they had no set designation for God, that they let each drunk decide what their personal God might be, but if they didn't believe in a God, that was okay too. None of it made any sense," he said. He says, "they're not looking for any publicity that our paper could give to them. They said their actions would be publicity enough for the time being. And they weren't even looking for credit or glory or anything natural or common sense like that. In fact, they weren't even using their last name. It seems that who got credit didn't seem to matter at all. But the strangest thing is that when I asked them how they were related to the problem of alcoholism, which had become the number one killer in the world, they really threw me. Because it seemed that they were more interested in the individual drunk than they were in the problem." He says, "I stuck around for quite a while, and they're just not doing anything the way that they should. But somehow the darn thing works, and they get sober, and they seem happy as hell to return to society as members and human beings." And the editor frowned and said, "Isn't there something similar to this some years back?" And an old codger in the back of the room said, "Yes, there was. It was called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was founded in 1935, and the editor says, "Well, what happened to it?" And the old codger says, "Well, it seems that they kind of got carried away with their own publicity. They began to believe their press clippings. Somehow they got the idea that they were alcoholic experts, and started telling everyone how to run their program. They got so busy telling everybody who would listen how good they were, all they had done and could do, that they didn't have any time to go out and do anything. He said, I can remember that they began to argue over money, and it took a lot of money to finance some of their projects, and their tremendous conferences, and their tremendous conventions, and their banquets, and their anniversaries, and everything else. But he says, I think personally that the two reasons that they folded was because they got so involved with the problem of alcoholism that they just simply didn't have time to talk to a drunk. And then pretty soon, because they were out of their depth in the wrong field, they became just another agency in the field of alcoholism. But probably in my mind, the biggest reason that they didn't survive was because the leaders forgot to replace themselves until it was too late, simply because they didn't want to let go. And then the editor asked the old guy how he knew so much about AA. And he replied, well, he says, I was one of those newcomers to AA. In whose hands AA was to be delivered. And I waited and I waited and I studied and I studied, but they never turned it over to me because I didn't have the experience and I might make mistakes. And at that point, I usually wake up and I sit up in the bed. My mind is a little bit fuzzy and I shake my head a little bit. I blink my eyes a couple times and I ask myself a real stupid question. You know, that's downright silly, Jim. That sort of thing couldn't possibly happen. Or could it? Thank you very much.